everybody. I'm Dr. Deb, and welcome to another episode of PTSD and Beyond. Welcome to the PTSD and Beyond podcast, where we give you insights into post-traumatic stress, trauma recovery, healing, and beyond. I'm Dr. Deb Lind, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind, touch your heart, and connect with your spirit, and also give you a greater understanding of yourself and others on this healing and recovery journey walked by so many of us before, wounded healers with lived experience and heroes. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into possibilities and purpose, hope, and inspiration. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. One last thing, guys, before we dive into today's episode, if you'd like an ad-free experience and like early access to new episodes and special events, I want to let you know you can join us at patreon.com. That is patreon.com/PTSD and beyond. All right, let's do it. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb here with PTSD and Beyond. I want to welcome back Dr. Harry Stark today. He's going to talk with us about trauma denial. And before we introduce him, and I want to give a shout out on an initiative that he's working on right now. This is super cool, especially when it involves our youth. And Dr. Stark is now a judge for a California initiative through Directing Change, which he's evaluating high school students' videos about suicide prevention. So how cool is that? A major shout out, kudos to you, Dr. Stark. Welcome back to PTSD and Beyond.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And I appreciate you bringing that in. And I'm sure there are other programs out there that do similar things, and we need to support that.
Well, you're one of the clinical psychologists that also has a social media presence. And I wrote myself a note here because when I think of you and the stuff that you put out on your socials, you're like the Twitter poster for mental health extraordinaire. That's what I wrote down. I thought,
oh my God.
So who is Dr. Harry Stark here? So if our listeners are not following you yet, make note, go on to Twitter and follow Dr. Harry Stark. His information will be in that summary bio there, because you put out things and that, you know, you get people to pause and think, you know, pause and think and then respond. And one of the things that came up was about trauma denial.
Yeah. 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 When I saw that particular article, it's like another flavor of the ice cream. Trauma is the ice cream, and trauma denial is another flavor of it. Maybe to carry the analogy a little bit more forward would be it's a higher fat content and higher sugar content form of ice cream. None of this low carb stuff. This is real intense.
Right. That is fantastic. I love the analogy, and it gives people a good visual of, you know, ice cream, and then that higher fat content, that real dense ice cream that when you taste it, you think to yourself, okay, so how many calories is in this? And do I really want to finish the double cone that I just ordered? And trauma denial is that mass, that trauma mass. And what happens to it, you know, when we do deny trauma? What happens to people when they're pushing it under the rug? It's something that they won't look at. Maybe they're coping in a way with distraction to the extreme of, you know, I don't know that. I don't know that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to use a term that I hope doesn't become off-putting, but I think it's a form of delusion. It's a delusional mindset. And I hear it oftentimes with addicts, that sense of, I know what I'm doing, or I've got this, or whatever, when in fact they don't, and they don't really know what they're doing. With trauma denial, it's this delusion that where the person, I think, convinces themselves that just because they're able to put one foot in front of another and get through the day and check all the boxes and finish their assignments and all that, that they must be okay, when nothing is further from the truth. It's not crossing the finish line. It's how you get to the finish line. And so I think trauma denial is delusion of the highest order. Just because you're not overtly symptomatic doesn't mean you're okay. I mean, the evidence is there. The symptoms really are there if you just take the time to notice them.
You know, you bring up a good point about the delusion component. So I'm functioning just fine. Maybe a person is they're at a career point where they've received, you know, multiple awards, multiple promotions. And so that advancement actually then supports the delusion, right? Yeah, I'm right. Doing really great. Look at me now. You know, I mean, hey, I mean, I got like a team of 200 people underneath me, and, you know, the stuff that's happened can't be that bad because look at where I'm at now. But I think that there's different layers of this denial too, right? I want to say awareness moments. What happens when somebody goes from I'm delusional to now I got to address it? Where's that in between space and what happens?
I think it's sort of like a smoke alarm where the battery is starting to go. You hear the chirp, but you don't really hear it like, oh, that's the smoke alarm. It's kind of like in the back of your head. You know? And then maybe it happens again. And then maybe it happens again until finally you go, okay, there's something going on here. I'm noticing this. The noise was there always.
Yep.
But, you know, it's, did you shut down the television? Did you turn off the radio? Did you shut down the video that you're streaming online? Did you, you know, are you really quieting down? Because the noise is there. Mm-hmm. It's there. But are you really starting to pay attention to it? So I think that middle ground is just that pause of, hey, did I hear something? You know, was something there? But of course, we've trained ourselves, certainly in our society, there's this dominant training of just keep going, keep going, keep going.
Right. What I'm hearing you say too is that at some point with the noise, we can't drown out that noise anymore. We can't keep pushing the button, the pause button. At some point, we're going to push the button and the noise is going to be louder and louder and louder. And that button pushing is going to be ineffective, which then the person is either going to have a more significant unhealthy coping, right?
So yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or they actually then do something that's healthy and constructive to address the denial component.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's so many analogies that are just flooding to the front of my mind on this. You know, it's the person who feels like a little twinge in their back or in their chest when they were climbing a flight of stairs, but then just ignores it, and they ignore it and ignore it and ignore it until finally they got to get their chest cracked open for bypass surgery.
Right.
Or on the more emotional interpersonal side of it, you know, in my clinical practice, I don't know how many times, but it's more than I've got digits on my hands and on my feet. But how many times I've had couples call me for couples therapy saying, well, we've tried everything, but now we feel like we're just going to give therapy a try. It's like, boy, the horse is so far out of the barn on this one. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's that sense of, by the time you really do start to pay attention to it, if you've been in that delusion for too long, it just makes it so much harder, so much harder.
So let's fast forward on someone who maybe was previously in denial. Okay. And so now they're saying, you know what? I can't deny this anymore. I can't ignore it anymore. And I'm going to go do something about it. And I'm seeking therapy. How do we help identify the different layers of denial? And so what I mean by that is, first, there's the denial and the delusion of it's not saying that trauma wasn't there.
is saying that I need help to get the, so we're first ignoring the trauma. Now we're acknowledging that the trauma was there. Yes, it was in fact there, right? It happened. And then it's the, it's not that bad. I don't need to get help, or they just don't go and get help, right? They're denying that they need assistance. And then the other step is, and I'm not saying this is linear, the awareness becomes, I need to go get help. So it's like the person, for example, who's an alcoholic that says, like you were saying earlier, you know what? I've got this under control. You know, it doesn't control me. I can quit at any time. And then something happens. And then they actually say, you know what? I have a drinking problem. I have a drinking problem.
Yeah.
And now I need to go get help. So how can, what are some things that we can do to help people move from these stages, or what are some common reasons why people actually start moving to these stages is maybe the question to ask instead.
Well, I think your use of the comparison to alcoholics is also really appropriate. So I'm going to kind of backdoor my way into answering your question by giving a very common experience I've had. With clients who have started up with me saying, I've got a problem with alcohol. Here's my goal in therapy. I want to get to where I just can drink on the weekends because they're afraid of losing their jobs or whatever. And I fully always give credit to the people who've trained me, my mentors. And I was taught that you can't force somebody to really embrace change. They've got to go after it. You can't force somebody to change, but they're not really embracing it. And they're just going to reflexively do something else somewhere else. So with those clients who say, I want to just, you know, drink on the weekends, I'll say, okay, let's see what we can do with that. Let's see how that goes. And it takes, you know, anywhere from 2 to 6 to maybe 8 or 10 weeks for them to realize, okay, that's not a viable goal. They're just not able to do it. So to kind of get more direct, I think using that model, if somebody has gotten to the point where they're really willing to acknowledge something's going on, mm-hmm. but they're not ready to give up the promotion that they've busted their ass to get for the last 10 years or something like that. They're not willing to give up the income that comes with it, or they don't want to give up the social status, or they don't want to be seen as weak or feeble or something like that. Then I think you can just start out with saying, okay, here's where you are. You've identified that something's going on. Let's work with this and let's see, make sure that door is open, that by working on this, whatever the this is in the moment, there might be some other things to address. Mm-hmm. Not forcing the issue by saying, okay, well, we're going to work on your short temper with your kids, or we're going to work on you had that explosion at a business, you know, meeting or whatever. We're just going to work on, you know, that sort of individual moment, and then let's see what else comes of that. Where, you know, and I always ask the question, it's nothing novel. It's like, is this familiar to you?
Right.
Were there other times where you thought, oh, I could have exploded that way, but I didn't? You know, and why was that? And what was keeping you? And you know, for people who are ready and really feeling encouraged, they'll start to look at things. And I always approach it as, these are options. None of these are have-tos. These are just options. So that sense of also making sure there's a message of choice every step of the way, and that nobody would be humiliated, shamed, diminished in standing if they make a choice that you and I know is unhealthy.
Right.
You know, there's just not, because that's going to break the rapport. That's going to ruin any kind of motivation the person has to go forward. And Lord knows if they're going to seek any help going down the road.
Yep. Do you think that trauma denial, let's just say a person is in their therapy session and the therapist says, you know, what you're describing to me is post-traumatic stress and someone sits there and says, you know, they don't have the concept of what they went through was as bad as they thought. You know, so for example, some survivors of child abuse, for example, when they do share their story and they see other people's reactions to it, it surprises them.
It
surprises them because it doesn't surprise them. What surprised them and has surprised them is the labeling that this is called something. Wow, I had no idea that this is called something, right? So there's it's one of the, I didn't know what I don't know. And then somebody brought up to share knowledge and information with me. So when a person who's experienced and they're sitting on that other side, right? And their therapist says, this is, you know, complex post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress. And they have then different levels of denial that are overcome through processing information as well as education. So how can we reframe trauma denial to become trauma denial awareness?
I think it's cool because the way you phrased it, I think, starts with the answer. When you said, like as an example, and I know you were just giving an example. This is not a critique on you, but this is how my mind works.
Yep.
When you said somebody's presenting and you say, you know, that's post-traumatic stress or that's, you know, that qualifies as that diagnosis. I would approach it as this sounds like post-traumatic stress or complex post-traumatic stress. And I would say, here are some of the hallmarks. Does any of this sound familiar? Without kind of forcing the label onto them, but really allowing them to find a way to connect with what that label is. Because, you know, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, also known as the Big Book of Pain, is full of a lot of titles, but it's misleading because they're really just labels for clusters of symptoms that seem to hang together.
Yep.
And so giving somebody their own way to connect with it is empowering. And if you think about it, dealing with trauma denial also requires belief that you have some power in the game. You have some control that you can actually start to implement. As a side note, I would also add in that one of the things that really increases the presence of trauma denial are the different careers that people are in, their sense of this is something, well, this is part of the job. Mm-hmm. You know, anywhere from the ER surgeon to the criminal attorney to the mom who's raising three kids, age span, you know, 6 months, 3 years, and 6 years. You know, they're all kind of dealing with their own forms of trauma. But if they say, well, this is the job, you know, the criminal attorney says, well, these are the cases that I have and I've got to see them through and people's lives are depending on me. The ER surgeon who's saying, you know, this is the job. This is what being in an ER is. Or the mom with the three kids. This is what being a mother is, you know, and those are the mechanisms that keep the person in denial. And to kind of really introduce that just because you chose a particular path in life doesn't mean you're not experiencing trauma.
Right. Exactly. Just because you picked a certain path in life doesn't mean that you're not experiencing trauma.
Yeah. Maybe that's also one of the big hangups that people have as I'm thinking about it now, that there's an immediate barrier of, well, I chose this. So how can I call it trauma?
Mm-hmm. Right. I chose this. So how can I call it trauma? We can look at law enforcement in the same way or folks in the military the same way. I think it would be a little bit difficult for, say, a survivor of domestic violence or child abuse to have that same phrase of thought. It might be modified, though different. It might be something I'm like, but these are my parents. These are my family members, right? This is
right.
That the words are different, but the intent is the same.
Yeah. In fact, you're bringing out the, I don't mean this in a endorsing positive way, but this is the beauty of it, is that there are so many different ways for this to come about, that there is no cookie cutter that says, oh, this is what equals trauma.
Right. Yep, exactly. And that's a really good point too. I had a conversation with someone recently, and it always amazes me when you're having a conversation about trauma and then the response is, oh, I thought that was a vet thing. It's like, okay, well, first of all, I'm not laughing because it's not funny. I'm laughing because how many times do we have this conversation? And I said, well, there are veterans who, you know, can experience PTSD as well as it can, you know, result from other types of traumatic experiences and situations. So the education is ongoing. Why would somebody want to stay in trauma denial?
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Deb. Thank you so much for being here today and listening to the PTSD and Beyond podcast. To learn more about our workshops, keynotes, as well as individual coaching, give us a shout out at Dr. Deb at PTSDandBeyond.org.
I think number one that comes to mind is self-esteem. I have seen people endure the most horrific, unhealthy situations because they believe that if they, you know, stepped out of it, let alone even ask for help, that they will lose their standing.
Wow. Do you think that's something that's a cultural, something that's imposed culturally or socially or both?
Yes. I think it's a recumbent process where one feeds the other and then the other feeds the one, and it becomes very cyclical,
mm-hmm.
very cyclical.
It's like that infinite regress argument, right?
Yep.
There's Descartes all over again.
Yeah.
You know, when someone makes the choice to say, okay, I know something, this isn't working for me anymore, right? Whether it means that their relationships aren't, you know, where they want them to be, they keep losing people, keep, you know, the same patterns, they recognize the same thing, like this is happening again, this again and again and again. And they finally say to themselves, something needs to change, right? Because nothing changes unless something changes. What are some of the first things that maybe somebody who's ready to move from the denial phase to the acceptance, if we're looking at the, you know, grief model, for example, to move from trauma denial to, I don't want to say acceptance, right? But they're acknowledging. There's a difference between acceptance and acknowledging. I'm acknowledging that I need to do something because isn't working.
So I think, to use a little bit different language, but I give my clients, and I even encourage my students on this, that it starts with four words. Calm the, in this case, I'll say hell down, or calm the heck down. There are other colorful words that I would include in there as a descriptive, but it starts with that. Every piece of research I've looked at, everybody who has done advances in trauma work, that one thing just keeps coming out as the very foundation. Just to create some space for the nervous system to calibrate down. But there's something you said earlier about that difference, that point of being in the trauma denial versus, you know, getting to where you're hearing the chirping and you're saying, I got to do something. Don't calm down so much that you fall asleep. even though sleep is important and it's restorative, I'm talking about calm down where you're still away and you can just start. You can just start to differentiate what's going on with you. There's a guy, Dan Siegel, does a lot of stuff in regards to this approach called, he called Wheel of Awareness.
Right.
And I really love that exercise that he laid out because it just gives a person that space to be quiet and to notice things. You don't have to do anything with it. You know, again, what's going to make somebody adverse to doing anything about their trauma is if you start giving obligations to them. You have to do this. Now I want you to do this. Now I want you to do that. But if, I think so much of the foundational work is just creating that space. Just create some space, be quiet, and then from that, then you can start asking questions. That would, to me, would be the next step. Instead of, I need to do something about this, I need to fix this problem, rather ask a question. What would it be like if I fixed this problem? What might it look like if I started to work on this? That questioning starts to access the abstract thinking, gets into the right hemisphere, and you start to really get at the scripts we're following all our lives.
Yep, exactly. We had Dr. Dan Siegel on the podcast, and he talked about the Wheel of Awareness, and it was actually something that was very surprising because I was hoping that we would go in the direction to talk more about his work and the wheel. And he did a very nice synopsis of what it is and how it can help people. You're talking about right now specifically too about a question and asking ourselves questions. I find that when we ask ourselves questions as opposed to give ourselves statements, that we're freeing up a space that reduces shame and stigma that self imposed, as well as other things that we've heard other people say, and we adopt that. It's like that tape that plays. So by asking questions, we're creating an openness and space for us to even just sit with that question. We don't need to have an answer to it right away. It gives us a moment to think about what does that question mean to me in this moment, and how can that question make my life better? How can it help me be my best self? And best can be defined in any way. It doesn't, you don't even have to define it in that moment, but questions open up thought. Questions release feelings. Questions then put us in a position of curiosity and inquiry, which is free of judgment and shame. And I think that the denial piece can be rooted sometimes in shame and stigma because of what's attached to that trauma.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. There's what, think about it, you know, not that you don't know this, but it's that sense of trauma is statements. You must do this. You cannot do that. Questions. You can't ask a genuine question of yourself and be in a traumatized moment at the same time. The two are antithetical to each other. Mm-hmm. To be curious, to ask yourself a question and play out the question requires your nervous system to be calibrated down, back into balance, homeostasis. You can notice things, you can explore things. And, you know, the questions don't have to have a predetermined outcome. You can have four or five or 400 or 500 different ways that it could play out. Although now that I think of it, four or 500 might bring on a different type of trauma. But because there is something about having too many choices that can overload the system.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what makes sometimes the work that we do individualized. We talk about, we share successes and we share things that work because they might work for other people. And at the same time, we're also mindful that things might need to be adjusted or recalibrated for someone else because just take salt, for example. I like to use food analogies. You know, what one person might think is tasteful using salt, somebody else might say, oh my gosh, that just is so salty. So we have to, you know, be mindful and meet people with where they're at. When it comes to trauma denial, what's the harm if someone chooses to be in a state of trauma denial throughout their life? And why I'm asking this question is somebody posted on Twitter, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, I think it was on Friday, about a relative that's in their mid to late 80s. And they were saying, with everything that's happened, they're probably not going to do the work. And I thought, that's really interesting, right? So why would a person choose to stay in the denial state? And I know we talked about career. I'm looking at people as they continuously get older, right? So maybe the career isn't the holdback.
No. So if we peel back career or status or all of that, my way of thinking about it right now is kind of the devil I know versus the devil I don't.
Uh-huh.
And the devil I don't know is worse. So it's got to be, I know this misery. I don't know what that misery might be, but what my instincts are telling me, the instincts that are the result of an overloaded nervous system, you're still in fight or flight, but maybe you've passed into a vagal response. And all of a sudden you say, well, whatever that new misery might be, it's going to be worse.
Yep.
And so I think that would keep anybody locked in.
You know what? That brings up some other points that come to my mind working in organizations about change, right? Mm-hmm. I know the vendor that I have right now and I know their issues, but if I go to somebody else, it's going to be much worse. And I know that, you know, change theory in organizations is different than, say, you know, change with individuals. And there are some overlapping and concepts that, you know, you can say, oh yeah, I can see that. But that's actually a really good analogy because it does go back to that root of, you know, the unknown is worse than what I have right now. So I'm just going to stay with where I'm at. What are some examples of successes that we define as success, like a person who was in trauma denial, they went through the awareness, they've done some therapy, and I don't want to call it the go beyond. There's an afterlife, if you will, of moving through trauma denial and moving through that denial of trauma and doing the work. So what does that look like? What can that look like for folks? And I appreciate the listeners that are still here because we have a few minutes, but it's a question that I think people might help them with being able to visualize, like, well, what does that look like? If I take the risk and I don't toe dip anymore, I take the risk, I jump in, I'm all in Dr. Stark, I've jumped in. So what does that look like?
I think that it can look like to go back to the ice cream analogy at the front end, it can look like, but now in a positive way, the difference between getting some, you know, kind of non-ice cream thing versus the real thing. It can look like maybe your job doesn't change per se, but all of a sudden you know that it's important to really be mindful of the time that you have outside of your job or even during your job, that you can create more human connections. Whether it's the people with whom you work, family, friends, the people in the environment, institutions in the environment that you value and can actually do something. And of course, your relationship with yourself, that you're not losing yourself. You can always identify the I as you move through each day. Sometimes it's on a rotisserie, and all of these things play in. There was a movie that came out, I don't remember how many years ago, called About Time. Any movie that deals with time travel, I'm already interested. And this was, I think, made by the guy who did Love Actually. And the culmination of the movie, I'm sorry for your listeners of the podcast who have not had a chance to see it, but you've had several years, you lose the chance to be surprised, is that he, the main character, decides that he's going to relive each day a second time so that he can, he already knows what's going to happen. He knows the job that he has to do, he knows the thing. But now the second time that he does it, he looks at people's faces and he notices the humanity around him, whether it's this person smiling at him, whether it's people who are dealing with a tough time in their lives. He's able to connect with that humanity. And I think that the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, at the very minimum, is just simply having a more expanded experience of your own human life. Because we've got a lot going up in our brain. We've got a lot going on in our lives. And if we're just really narrow focused on just make it through one foot in front of the other, get through the end of the day, eat your dinner, go to bed, pay your bills, get to work, and just rinse and repeat everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to shorten your life. It's just going to shorten your life or make you want to shorten your life.
Yep. Yeah. It's very mechanical.
Yeah.
As opposed to your living. You know, you go from being very mechanical in the way that the day is and the way that the life is, as opposed to I'm really living. So everything that I hear is about an increased quality of life and how that's meaningful to that person.
Yeah. 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 Another, I know we're short on time. I want to give another quick example. It's the difference. I heard somebody talk about this one time and I related to it so much. It's the difference between like being on a flight for those people who are still flying or starting to fly, and you're offered a drink. And, you know, the staff says, we can give you some soda. You go, what kind of soda? And they go, oh, whatever, bland. And they'll say, would you like a diet or do you want regular? And being stuck and really stymied with what do I want? Do I want? Am I allowed to want? Can I have? Until finally the person in relating it blurts out, I'll have the diet. Fine, I'll have the diet. As though there was a persecution going on. Versus if you're calm, if you've got that space for yourself, you can actually say, well, what do I want?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I want the diet. Maybe I want the regular.
Maybe you want cranberry juice.
Well, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can't get to that point if your nervous system is lit up like a Christmas tree all the time.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You can't get to that point if your nervous system is lit up like a Christmas tree. Some of us still have our Christmas trees up, by the way.
I'm aware of that. No judgment from me.
What are some last points that you'd like to share with our listeners? Maybe three other key things about trauma denial that come to mind that you're thinking and saying, you know what, I really would like to share this before we conclude today.
I think it's a normal part of our nervous system to want to protect, but to recognize that instinct to protect is unnecessary. As I like to explain to some of my clients, there is no real tiger coming down to eat us up. You have the ability to contemplate. But if you act as if there's a tiger coming to eat you up, you're not going to contemplate. So, you know, yes, the calm, but also maybe being mindful that everything that's done very quickly, reflexively, is usually something done to protect.
Mm-hmm.
And if we kind of open our eyes a little bit and become curious, I wonder what the other person is experiencing. You don't have to agree with them. So that's another aspect of this. Being empathic or even curious about somebody else's perspective doesn't require that you agree with them. And so that can also go a very long distance in helping to kind of come out of the trauma, you know, those expectations that we believe we have to have about ourselves, other people, who fits in what category, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. That's awesome. That is one other thing that I've looked at too, is that contemplation opens up that space. When you contemplate, you're asking yourself questions. Other people, maybe you're reading a book and the author writes questions, or maybe writes a statement that makes you think of a question, and it provides that pause and that space that you reflect a little bit deeper, or even maybe start looking around. Someone else posted this on Twitter just recently about change, like the two things about change. What do you think about change? How does change happen? We're getting into epistemology here. How do I know what is true, right? How do I adopt what I know is true? As I'm looking at my bookshelf here, I have books still from undergrad, believe it or not. The point of the matter is with trauma denial, with contemplation, you can ask yourself some questions. There are things that we can also post to on Monday. Tomorrow, we're having the PTSD and Beyond global Twitter chat specifically about trauma denial. And there are questions there that are contemplative questions to ask yourself and to not necessarily answer, but to explore. And that's what I hear you saying. I hear you saying there are things that we can do to open up the space to contemplate and explore, and then to identify things like human connections, family, friends. You know, what does my quality of life look like? What can it look like?
Yeah. And notice that I never said, oh, if you really do this, then you'll be able to get out of the career that's going nowhere for you. It's like, no. I mean, yes, that can certainly happen. But let's bring it down to its very core elements. And so that's why I kind of avoid some of those examples, you know, job pursuits, et cetera.
Right.
Even though that is absolutely true, I think it's more achievable, more universal to just let's hone in on human experience.
Human experience, and then our experience with ourselves. You even touched on it too and said, what's the relationship with myself? Because at the end of the day, trauma denial is something that affects us, and we internalize it and we hold on to it. And maybe somebody's listened to this podcast today and they're starting to think about something. And that thinking, that contemplation, that space provides movement, and movement for a relationship with yourself.
You know, Dr. Deb, if that happens, and I don't mean if, like it won't, if that happens, even if it's just one person, that would be the most moving thing for me. If anybody can do it and then, you know, continue it, pay it forward,
right?
Whatever, that's the glory. That's the glory.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that completely, which is another reason why when you posted about trauma denial, I thought, oh my gosh, we've got to do another podcast together, because this is so important for getting the message out there. And with the number of people that listen to this podcast, I mean, I know that we're in over 96 countries now, and for the, we just ended March. So I have to go back and look. I think that number, so number one for March was the United States. Number two was Canada, and number three was Belgium, which is great. Wow. There's like this jockeying going back and forth between Australia, UK, and now Belgium just decided to say, hey, you know, want to know what? No, we're pushing those guys out of the side, and we're taking the number three spot. And why I say that is because I look to see, and we look to see where our listeners are at, which podcasts are resonating with people. So what more messaging and information can we share with listeners? So if there is somebody right now who is thinking that this did resonate, you know what, it's made a lot of sense, and you want to give us some feedback, drop us a line at info@ptsdandbeyond.org. Go ahead and reach out to Dr. Harry Stark. Again, his information is in the summary bio. And Dr. Stark, again, it was a pleasure to have you back on. to talk about trauma denial. I think you're absolutely amazing. I have a bias there because you do, you put stuff out there and I think, oh my gosh, this is just so important. We've got to capture this. So thank you again so much for being here today.
You're welcome. And thank you. You're doing a marvelous job.
Oh, thank you so much. Guys, this is Dr. Deb with PTSD and Beyond. Remember to hit us up on Patreon or even Ko-Fi. I really do appreciate those sponsorships because we are an indie podcast. We put it out there for you. And if there's anything else that you guys want to see as subjects or guests, again, give us a shout out at info@ptsdandbeyond.org. Drop us a note. Otherwise, we'll see each other again next week. All right, make it a good one.